are now. Fulbright kept his eyes on her. Find him. We need him on the Joint Task Force. Tell him we'll offer amnesty and U.S. citizenship if you think it will matter. Just get him here. In the meantime, I need you and your people focused and working to find a way to stop this thing. Is that clear? She did not respond with enthusiasm.
Yes, sir.
Fulbright didn't relent. Are we clear on this?
Sir,
You are a perceptive woman, Natalie. You of all people should be able to do the math on this. If we risk the lives and livelihoods of hundreds of millions of people to save the life of a single man, we'll be guilty of a heinous crime. Do you see the truth of this? She nodded after a moment. Now, perhaps you can gain some appreciation for the cruel calculus I'm forced to use every day. He put a hand on her shoulder. Your heart is in the right place. There's nothing wrong with that. But keep a sense of perspective. Ask yourself how many children you'd be willing to sacrifice so that Detective Seebeck can live. Phillips realized he was right. The general cleared his throat. I need to report back to the Pentagon. Phillips turned to the deputy director. He nodded. She called after the general.
There's more, sir.
Let's hear it.
I detected something unusual emanating from the networks of demon-infected companies. It's a pulse, an IP beacon of sorts. The tech industry calls these heartbeats. This one consists of a lengthy burst of packets emanating from TC port 135 at a predictable interval and bit length. Once we noticed the beacon was present at infected companies, we started looking for it elsewhere on the Internet. We found it echoing all over. That's how we estimate that 3,800 corporations have been compromised. Some of those companies might not even know they're infected yet.
The general was nonplussed. What's the purpose of this IP beacon?
That was the question. We first thought it might be a signal to indicate a company was a demon host. But then the signal wouldn't need to be so long. And each burst is a pretty long stream of data. It's always identical for a single company, but never the same between two different companies. And all companies projected in a sequence, like a chain. A pulse from Company A is sent to Company B, then from Company B to Company C, and so on until we start back at Company A again. Stranger still, when our infiltration attempt caused one company to be destroyed, another beacon appeared at a new company to take its place. And it exactly matched the beacon that was lost.
She paused.
That's when I first suspected this was a multi-part message.
The companies are communicating with each other?
No. They're communicating to us.
The general weighed what that meant. He regarded Phillips with something akin to dread. What are they saying?
The message was encoded with a 128-bit block cipher. It took us weeks to decrypt, and that was on cold iron. The good news is that, besides the Japanese and maybe the Chinese, it will take other nations years to decrypt. So we're convinced that Sobel intended it for us. When we assembled the constituent pieces from all the beacons at all the companies, we discovered a single, very large GNU compressed file. When we extracted the package contents, we found two things. An API and an MPEG video file.
What's an API?
It's an application programming interface, rules for controlling a process. It's basically a guide for communicating with and possibly controlling the demon.
Good Lord! Why would Sobel give us that?
I think it's a trap, sir.
What sort of control is it saying it will give us?
We've only begun our analysis, but the most significant function we've discovered is in the Demon's Ragnarok class library. It's a function named Destroy. It accepts a country code and attacks ID as arguments. We believe that invoking it destroys all the data in the target company.
The general thought about this. My God, why would he give that to us?
We don't know yet.
You said there was a video. What did the video contain? Phillips took a deep breath.
Something you need to carry up the chain of command.
In the boardroom of building OPS-2B, the group of agency directors sat arrayed around a broad mahogany conference table. The tension was thick as ominous looks passed from one director to the next. Their host opened the emergency meeting. NSA.
Gentlemen, you are all aware of the gravity of the current situation. I brought in representatives from both Computer Systems Corporation and its subsidiary, Endocorp, to provide additional technical expertise in this matter. These are the same folks who built the FBI's new case management system. They are cleared Umbra, so we may speak freely. Some of you have already worked together at NBP1.
Both representatives gave dour nods. They were in their 40s and looked more conservative than window mannequins in the FBI gift shop.
NSA. What you're about to see is a matter of the utmost secrecy. Were this information to be made public, there is every likelihood that the world economy would falter.
He let it sink in.
A Group has decrypted a video message from Matthew Sobel.
An animated buzz spread through the room. He waited until it died down. NSA.
We're going to screen that video. Watch it carefully, and we'll discuss it afterwards. Lights, please.
The lights dimmed, and a plasma screen set into the wall glowed to life. In a moment, Matthew Sobel appeared in high-definition color. The image was so clear, it seemed as if a window had opened in the side of the somber boardroom. Sobel stood outdoors in the sun on high ground overlooking the ocean. He was dressed in khakis and a pressed linen shirt. He looked normal, healthy, the breeze tossing his hair. Sobel betrayed no emotion. He stared into the camera for several moments before speaking.
They built a $20 trillion house of cards. Then they told you to guard it. And they call me insane.
Sobel started to walk along the cliff's edge. The camera followed him, steadicam-like in medium close-up.
Technology. It is the physical manifestation of the human will. It began with simple tools. Then came the wheel. And on it goes to this very day. Civilizations rise and fall based on technological innovation. Bronze falls to iron, iron falls to steel, steel falls to gunpowder, gunpowder falls to circuitry.
Sobel looked toward the camera again.
For those among you who don't understand what's happening, let me explain. The Great Diffusion has begun. An era when the nation-state dissolves. Technology will cause this. As countries compete for markets in the global economy, diffusion of high technology will accelerate. It will result in a diffusion of power. And diffusion of power will make countries an ineffective organizing principle. At first, marginal governments will fail. Larger states will not be equipped to intercede effectively. These lawless regions will become breeding grounds for international crime and terrorism. Threats to centralized authority will multiply. Centralized power will be defenseless against these distributed threats. You have already experienced the leading edge of this wave.
Sobel stopped walking and gazed longingly out at the ocean. In a moment, he turned to the camera again.
My demon is not your enemy, and thankfully, it cannot be stopped by anyone or anything. It is neither good nor evil. It is like fire, and it will burn those who do not learn to use it. It will burn the enemies of reason. It will burn the hypocrites and the fools. Use the tools I've given you, and the demon will become a valuable resource. Or, if you prefer, don't. Remember that the demon is now firmly established throughout the world. Other cultures will use these tools, even if you do not.
He stared straight into the camera.
There will be violence soon. It will shock you with its scope and ferocity. Don't waste your time interceding. It isn't directed at you. It is directed at other parasites in the network. Distributed demons are a foregone conclusion in the coming world. You should befriend this one, because the next demon might not be so friendly. And, unlike your current leaders, my demon can protect you from your enemies.
The video ended, and the lights came up. Everyone looked suddenly haggard.
CIA. Jumping Jesus!
NSA. Gentlemen, you've seen the devil himself, and now we need to figure out what to do about him.
CIA.
Forget him! What can we do to stop his demon?
DARPA. We need to destroy the demon's darknet. That's what we need to do. This message is just propaganda, another misdirection. CSC.
Destroying the demon will require a coordinated cyber attack on numerous corporate data systems. An attack unprecedented in scale, a digital D-Day.
DARPA. Too risky. One misstep and the demon destroys thousands of companies.
Endocorp.
We can't just let this thing take over, whatever the cost.
FBI.
What does Sobel mean when he says there'll be violence? Is he talking revolution?
DARPA. He's a megalomaniac. DIA.
If he means revolution, we should have troops in the streets. Sobel could be planning a coup.
NSA.
The markets are already shaky. Mobilizing troops and declaring martial law will cause a panic.
CSC.
We have private security forces available.
CIA.
He said we weren't the target.
FBI.
You're not going to take him at his word, are you?
DIA.
He did say nation-states were doomed.
CIA.
Yes, but he didn't say he would be the instrument of their destruction. He could be warning us.
FBI.
You're starting to worry me.
CIA.
I don't mean that Sobel is on our side. I think he's an evil bastard. I mean, was an evil bastard. But he had a demented vision that I think we should try to wrap our heads around. He talked about small groups. The Great Diffusion is how he termed it. That small groups would be battling nation-states.
DARPA.
Sobel mentioned lawless regions and failed states. What if he was talking about terrorism?
DIA.
Terrorists use our own technology against us.
CIA.
And so do international crime rings. Does Sobel think his demon could be used against terrorism and transnational crime?
DARPA.
It took over the online porn and gambling industries easily enough.
NSA.
We've got to get a handle on this.
Endocorp.
Gentlemen, this demon is comprised of distributed network systems with a companion human network. This is no different than many enemies we've already defeated.
DARPA.
I think it's clearly different.
Endocorp.
In specifics, maybe, but not in the abstract. Whether he's dead or alive, Sobel's network can be disrupted and his people put to flight. In order to knock out his human network, we need to hit them hard and hit them everywhere. Keep them on the run and keep them looking over their shoulder.
CSC.
And in order to prevent the various demon components from interacting, we stage a regional power outage immediately preceding operations. We exert our control over major media outlets to prevent the demon from reading the news, or we fabricate the news to suit our purposes.
The directors seemed taken aback by the sudden turn in the discussion.
NSA.
What about the demon's human operatives? Wouldn't they still be able to communicate?
Endocorp.
This is classic infowar, which we invented. We have highly skilled cyber and electronic warfare experts. We'll be monitoring demon activities in coming weeks. And as for the demon's human operatives, they won't stand up long against ex-Special Forces soldiers. We've operated successfully in Colombia against left-wing rebels and narco-terrorists, and in sub-Saharan Africa against Islamic rebels. Our men operate in small groups with minimal supervision. No legislative oversight necessary.
CIA.
Well, that's fine in Colombia and sub-Saharan Africa, but how the hell are you going to sell that in Columbus, Ohio? And how do you tell friend from foe in a Tech Park server room?
Endocorp.
You don't. We move in our own people to operate the data centers and detain the current staff until we can satisfy ourselves that they pose no risk.
NSA.
This is crazy talk. You can't round up IT workers in thousands of companies. You don't have the manpower, for one thing. Also, a substantial percentage of the infected sites are in foreign countries. Most Fortune 500 companies have their back-office data processing operations in India and Southeast Asia.
Endocorp.
Borders mean nothing to us. We have private military provider and support firms in place in 25 countries, incorporated under 100 different names. And we have influential voices in dozens more countries. Certain financial interests currently at risk are willing to underwrite this effort to protect the global economy.
NSA.
The moment you attack, the demon will destroy the infected networks.
FBI.
He's right. There are too many targets to hit all at once.
The CSC representative looked soberly around the table.
CSC.
That's correct. That's why we need to pick and choose. If we defend a cross-section of Western interests in numerous industries, the global economy can achieve survivability, but only if strategic investments are made in the shares of selected survivors. This can defray the loss of the other companies.
The directors were speechless for a moment. DARPA, what about these tools that Sobel mentioned? The faces shifted in his direction. NSA, it's a programming interface of some type included in Sobel's message. Group A has a team analyzing the components now. They suspect Sobel might be extending some form of communication with his demon. Perhaps even rudimentary control.
FBI, what kind of control?
NSA, for starters, there's a function that, on demand, destroys the data of any chosen demon-infected company.
Everyone immediately grasped the significance of this. DARPA.
And this is still being broadcast around the world in an encrypted beacon?
NSA.
Yes, which means it's only a matter of time until other governments have this knowledge too.
CIA.
Sobel's force in our hand.
DARPA.
We'll need to see that API as soon as possible. It could provide intelligence on the topology of the demon's darknet.
FBI.
You're not seriously suggesting we start communicating with this thing. We don't negotiate with terrorists.
NSA.
No one's negotiating with anyone. This is an object library. We're analyzing it.
FBI.
Look. We've been messing around long enough. We need to kill it. It's taken over a big chunk of the Fortune 500, and it can cause irreparable harm to this nation.
CSC.
To the global economy.
NSA.
That's the whole point. If we make one move against it, the demon will flush all that corporate data down the toilet. And if we ignore it, then some other government might invoke the destroy function to attack us.
CSC.
We must attack it.
NSA.
I don't think losing 3/4 of the companies is an option.
Endocorp.
You need to move on Sobel's organization, infiltrate it, identify all the ringleaders, nab them, turn the screws on them, and roll their whole damned group. We've done it before.
CSC.
You'll need handpicked teams.
NSA.
Gentlemen, I hope we're not disturbing your meeting.
They looked impassively at the director.
Chapter 36, The Powers That Be. A gleaming Dassault business jet taxied out of the darkness and into a brightly lit, spotlessly clean hangar. It rolled to a stop alongside a black Cadillac Escalade and a Chevy Suburban. The aircraft engines whined to a stop as men in suits removed their ear protection and approached the plane. The jet door pulled in and open, letting down a short row of steps. In a moment, Russell Van Owen Jr. stepped from the plane, as always looking resplendent in a bespoke, black pinstriped suit. He cast his commanding gaze around the hangar. Everything looked secure. Only his hired security team was present. Core Security Services. Ex-Special Forces soldiers. Smart, capable, trustworthy. He strode toward the Escalade as one of his half-dozen bodyguards stepped up to meet him. The man reflexively saluted, then stopped in mid-salute with some embarrassment.
Good evening, Mr. Van Owen. Your guest is waiting, sir.
Van Owen nodded slightly in acknowledgement. The guard opened the passenger door of the Escalade. Van Owen noted with satisfaction the thickness of the door. Kevlar laminate armor and inch-thick bulletproof glass. It was a discreet business tank. Van Owen ducked inside and was unsurprised to see a man waiting for him in the plush back seat. The man was in his 40s, dressed in a sports coat and black shirt. He had buzz-cut hair and a firm jawline. Definite military look. They called him the Major, but that's all Van Owen knew about him. They had never met, but both of them knew their roles well. Van Owen settled into the empty seat. The door closed behind them with a tight thwop. The Major did not extend his hand.
You're 7 minutes late.
Van Owen nodded.
Yes, and so we need to hurry. I'm scheduled to make a keynote speech tonight at the convention center downtown.
Van Owen narrowed his eyes.
You're certain you weren't followed?
The Major ignored the question.
Get us moving.
Van Owen saw through the partition glass that the driver and bodyguard were now sitting up front.
He hit the intercom.
Downtown Biltmore.
They're getting the bags off the plane, sir.
Have them catch up with us at the hotel. Just get us moving.
Roger that, Mr. Van Owen. Van Owen turned back to the major.
My sources tell me the feds know which companies are infected by the demon.
The major showed no reaction. Van Owen continued.
And that only a minority of these companies are expected to survive.
The Escalade was now moving through the hangar doors and into the night. The major looked out the window.
If I were in a position to confirm such information... I already know it's true. What I need from you is the list of infected companies.
The major didn't blink.
Why do you think I'm here?
Van Owen was uncharacteristically surprised. He tried to find something to say.
No, I see. Leland Equity has friends in high places, Mr. Van Owen.
The major reached into his jacket pocket.
You seem to be under the impression that you have to save face. You weren't the only one to get caught in the demon's web.
The major produced a glossy brochure from his jacket.
But, as it turns out, Mr. Sobel may have inadvertently handed us the investment opportunity of a lifetime.
He handed the brochure to a suspicious Van Owen.
What's this?
Van Owen read the title. Annual Children's Hospital Golf Classic.
Is this a joke?
The major tapped the brochure.
Flip it open.
Van Owen did so. Inside the trifold was a long list of charity sponsors, company after company. Van Owen looked up to his guest.
I had operations printed. We're expecting a data loss of cataclysmic proportions within the next 6 months. That's a list of public companies targeted for special promotion by public and private militaries. Now you know how to restructure your portfolio. If anyone else sees it, it's just a charity brochure.
Van Owen smiled broadly.
And how much will Leland be donating to the Children's Golf Classic?
The major turned to look out the tinted windows into the night.
It's not for your benefit that you're being told, although I'm sure you'll do very well also. Perhaps I can offer you a commission for your investment advice?
The major looked blankly at him.
I'm just one of Leland's investors, Mr. Van Owen. Do your job and we'll have no reason to speak again.
Van Owen nodded vigorously.
Yeah, of course.
He folded the brochure and placed it in his suit pocket. The major pointed.
That list doesn't get entered into a computer, it doesn't get photocopied, and it doesn't get reported to anyone else without the approval of my superiors. Do you understand? Yes. You know what would happen if you were to lie to me.
Van Owen made eye contact.
Yes. Good. Make sure you remember it.
Van Owen sighed dramatically.
Well, what sort of special protection will these companies enjoy?
There's a demon task force, run by an NSA cryptologist, young black lady, very sharp. She's beginning to unravel the demon's design.
But if they figure out a way to stop the demon, then our investment opportunity is...
Van Owen's voice trailed off.
We don't intend to stop the demon. It's too valuable. The goal is to control it. The task force has made progress in just that area.
Control it?
Van Owen considered this.
Then we would still get our opportunity,
but with greater precision and total deniability. The demon could become a powerful economic weapon, particularly against the ascendant economies of Asia.
Van Owen thought of the possibilities.
So, the demon is not invincible after all.
He gestured to the nearby wet bar.
A scotch to celebrate?
The major shook his head.
It's a bit premature to be celebrating. In any event, I'll be leaving you in a moment.
He clicked on his own intercom button.
Roberts, leave me off at the next crossroads.
Affirmative, sir.
Van Owen raised his eyebrows, surprised that the major knew his driver's name.
Nothing has been left to chance, Mr. Van Owen. You have important work to do for us. See that you achieve your objectives.
In a moment, the Escalade slowed at a rural intersection. Two county roads meeting in the middle of nowhere beneath a lamp swirling with moths. The major turned to Van Owen.
We never met.
He was gone before Van Owen could say a word. The doors locked immediately after him. Van Owen watched a sedan emerge from the shadows to meet the major. In a moment,
Vanoan's Escalade was moving on, back into the darkness, on the other side of the intersection and down the country road, toward a smudge of light on the horizon. Distant suburban sprawl. Vanoan exhaled in relief. That had gone extraordinarily well. Better than he could have imagined. So, the wise men weren't holding him responsible. The demon was widespread. He found it strangely reassuring, especially since the powers that be weren't even phased. Matthew Sobel had underestimated them, and they were already taking steps to turn this situation to their advantage. In fact, he was going to have that celebratory scotch after all. Vanoan pulled a bottle of 30-year-old Macallan from the minibar and poured three fingers neat. He lifted the glass and sighed again in satisfaction, appreciating the caramel color against the backdrop of the headlights. Not only was he going to free himself of the demon, but he stood to make billions doing it. This was the very essence of capitalism, thriving on chaos. True, there would be a temporary economic meltdown, but like pruning a tree, it would grow back fuller and healthier than before, but thoroughly under their control. He raised his glass and toasted.
Here's to you, Mr. Sobel.
Beyond his scotch glass, Vanoan glimpsed a dark shadow growing ahead. Half a second later, it came screaming out of the blackness. It was a car with its headlights off. Vanoan's driver screamed. A Lincoln Town car nailed the Escalade dead center in the front grille at a combined speed over 150 miles per hour, instantly pancaking the sedan up to its rear passenger seat with a powerful boom and flattening the armored Escalade up to its front windshield. This sent the Escalade's V10 engine plowing into the front seat and blasted the inch-thick windshield out of its mountings, where it tumbled crazily hundreds of yards down the road. After the initial impact, the wreckage of the Escalade sheared away from the town car and went into a wild roll, sending pieces of metal and armored doors flying. What remained of the SUV landed upside down in the opposite lane nearly 100 yards farther on. Smoke and steam billowed from the wreck. After a few moments of dead silence, headlights appeared in the distance, back the way the Escalade had come. They grew rapidly brighter, accompanied by the growling of a powerful engine. Soon, a black convertible Mercedes SL sports coupe arrived and rolled to a stop near the start of the debris field. Its xenon headlights were aimed at the wreckage of the overturned Escalade, bathing it in white light. Twin black Lincoln Town cars, with their headlights off, pulled up behind the Mercedes like guardians. The throbbing engine of the coupe cut off, but the headlights stayed on. In a few moments, the door opened, and the dark form of the driver strode calmly into the light of his own headlights. Brian Gregg gazed intently at the wreckage. He was reborn. Gone without a trace, with the tattoos and the piercings and the unkempt hair. In their place was a perfectly groomed and successful-looking young man. Dressed as Sobel might dress, all in black with tailored slacks, silk shirt, and sports coat. Except for the black Synthex gloves and sports glasses he wore, he looked like any other Austin Tech entrepreneur. He was now invisible to authority, a man of substance. He sniffed the night air. It was thick with moisture and the aroma of field grass. The din of crickets filled his ears. He was never more alive than now. Never more happy, and never before could he see with such clarity. He could feel the world for miles around. Law enforcement GPS units, faction members, and automate packs networked in the surrounding countryside, feeding their discoveries to him, like wizards' familiars. Gregg felt the tingling of the third eye on his stomach and back. The third eye was another of the miracles that Sobel had bestowed upon him. It was a form-fitting conductive shirt worn next to the skin. But it wasn't a garment. It was a haptic device that helped him use his body's largest organ, his skin, as another all-seeing eye. An eye that never blinked. An eye that could see around him in 360 degrees, or halfway around the world if he wished. It worked by sending tiny electrical impulses to excite the nerve endings in his skin,
much like a computer monitor projected pixels onto a screen. The microscopic electrical impulses represented data, from blips on a radar screen to full-blown visual displays. But what amazed Greg was how the brain learned to accept input from this new source as if it were just another organ, just another eye. He felt the networks around him, but he could do more than just feel them. Greg motioned with his gloved hands. Suddenly, the headlights of the twin town cars flicked on. The cars roared forward and deployed on either side of the road at his command, illuminating the entire crash scene. Greg halted them with a wave of his hand. Glittering pieces of metal and plastic littered the roadway. Now he could see the pancaked wreckage of the automate he'd used in the attack. It was lying backwards in a ditch along the road about 50 feet ahead, smoking like a distillery. Only the rear half remained. Greg relaxed his arms and then cracked his knuckles. He strode toward the wreckage of the Escalade. Both the driver and the front passenger were clearly dead. Someone's intestines spilled out over the twisted frame and looped along the ground. The smell of butyric acid and bile was mercifully masked by the odor of antifreeze and burning plastic. Greg heard whimpering. He moved to the rear passenger compartment and peered through the empty, twisted doorframe. Inside, he saw only a jumble of spent airbags, white packing powder, and shattered glass. Greg listened intently, following the sound around to the other side of the wreck, where he soon saw the bloody and quivering form of Russell Van Owen lying twisted on his back on the pavement nearby. Greg took measured steps to look down on him, careful to avoid the pool of blood forming on one side. Van Owen's head and face were covered in blood. His right arm was mangled, splintered bones sticking through his torn sleeve. A long, slow groan came out of his toothless mouth and formless, swollen face. His nose was almost completely flat. Greg regarded him icily. He leaned down and with his gloved hands pulled back Van Owen's blood-soaked suit jacket. The wounded man's chest heaved, and his eyes stared in stark terror as Greg lifted out the bloody brochure for the Children's Golf Classic. Greg shook some of the blood off it and flipped it open. He held it to the light. It was still legible. Greg took out his cell phone and clicked a digital picture of it. Then he folded the brochure and slipped it back into Van Owen's chest pocket. Greg stood and turned to leave. Van Owen's groan ascended to a wail as he reached out toward Greg with his good arm. Greg stopped. He paused a moment before turning around, then kneeled down and grabbed Van Owen's swollen face with his gloved hand, causing the man to scream in agony.
"Shh, I'll go up a level for this. Maybe I should thank you, Russell."
He searched Van Owen's bloody eyes for something worthwhile.
"But then again, fuck you, you worthless piece of shit."
Tears streamed down Van Owen's cheeks. He was insane with fear and pain. There wasn't an ounce of pity in Greg's eyes.
"If you see Matthew Sobel, be sure to tell him Loki said hello."
Greg stood, straightened his jacket, and walked toward his Mercedes. He motioned with a gloved hand, and one of the Lincoln town cars screeched forward. The headlights flashed in Van Owen's eyes as he shrieked. The car crushed him under its wheels and dragged his corpse some ways down the road before it fell free. The black automate raced off into the night. Greg curled a finger at his Mercedes, and the car rolled forward to meet him. The driver's door swung open as it came alongside. Greg concentrated on his third eye. He felt his distant automates following the car of the mysterious man whom Van Owen had met at the municipal airfield. Greg brought the dashboard video of a trailing automate up onto his heads-up display, projecting onto one lens of his glasses. The infrared camera miles away showed the man's car heading south toward the interstate. There were two occupants. Greg scanned the target car's license plate and retrieved its DMV records.
"Federal fleet vehicle. No data," he thought.
Greg smiled to himself.
"The Demon Task Force, eh?"
He was closing in on them. He was mapping the topology of the plutocrats' elusive network, the money power. They were up to something. This man would help Greg find out what. These plutocrats were men of limited vision who needed to be swept aside. Men from a previous age, an age of oil and heavy industry. But the distributed technocracy would soon rise, and Greg would be there at Sobel's side for the dawn of a new age. An age of immortals. A second age of reason. Greg's eyes narrowed at the video image of the man's car. There would be no mercy for those who stood in the way. Chapter 37, Cogs in the Machine. The Haas Mini-Mill was a miracle of modern engineering. A computer-controlled metal lathe, drill press, and router all rolled into one. The Haas could download a 3D computer model into memory and from it produce a custom metal or plastic part, cut and shaped to exacting specifications. It was essentially a self-enclosed, water-cooled, machine part factory packed into a housing the size of a hot dog cart. Linked to the web, it almost became a 3D fax machine. Plans sent in digitally at one end emerged at the other as finished parts. The input could originate from any corner of the world via internet or phone. All that was required was a human being to serve the Haas, to feed it the raw materials the plans required, to protect it and maintain it. Man serving machine. But Kurt Volker and his crew loved their machines. The machines gave them entree into the Demon Network. The Demon Network gave them a future. They had progressed significantly since their first automate. Their Sacramento machine shop now boasted three $500,000 computer-controlled milling machines running full-time off dual cable and satellite internet connections. They were producing parts at an accelerating pace, but the Demon had forbidden their company from growing larger. Three machines were the maximum they were permitted to possess. True, they generated $3 million in revenue last year and took home hundreds of thousands of dollars each. But Volker chafed against the prohibition to stay small. Still, he knew better than to protest to Sobel's Demon. It had grown phenomenally in power. Better to give thanks for their good fortune. Volker lifted his safety goggles and glanced around the cluttered shop. It was 30,000 square feet of 1930s factory floor. Brick walls, 20-foot ceilings, skylights, and concrete floors. The smell of oil, burnt metal, and ozone from arc welding filled the air. Parts littered workbenches, and a dozen brand new vehicles stood in varying stages of completion. Volker's company was officially a fleet vehicle customization business, licensed to operate by the AQMD, a legitimate California corporation. Their close ties to major car leasing companies, on-time tax payments, and their contributions to civic causes put them above reproach. They had friends in high places now. High-powered attorneys would slide down the fire pole in their defense if anyone so much as looked at them cross-eyed. God help anyone who tried to shake them down or impede their business. There was a Demon work request for just such contingencies. Their future was secure. Volker saw Tingit Khan and Rob McCruder struggling with the steering column of a new Automate variant, a 400-horsepower Mustang Interceptor. They were bitching at each other like brothers, as always. Volker smiled to himself. They were like a family. A family with a stern authority figure that would flay the flesh from their bones if they stepped out of line for even an instant. Still, the rules were clear, the work always changing, and the rewards enormous. Barely in their mid-20s, they were all millionaires on paper. They would receive 5 weeks vacation every year, retirement with benefits in 20 years. They received financial advice money couldn't buy. Their medical plan, too, was top-notch. The Demon took care of its own. Volker turned toward his Haas milling machine. It was busy churning out grooved steel plates 6 inches long and an inch wide. He had no idea what they were for, but they had a work order for 300 copies. Some strategic plan somewhere required them, a plan born in the mind of a dead genius and enacted now when the time was right. But right for what? Only the Demon knew. Certainly no one among the living did. Volker took one of the finished plates and placed it in a laser scanner. He tapped a button, and the object was instantly measured at 2,000 critical points for accuracy. It was dead on. It was always dead on. The Haas knew what it was doing. A two-tone chime came in over the loudspeakers. Volker, Kahn, and Magruder looked up at the same time, then at each other. They all knew what it meant. New plans were in the queue. Volker motioned to them. I got it. They looked back down and kept working on the Mustang, while Volker took off his gloves. He moved to a nearby computer workstation. A new 3D plan file was in their company inbox. He noticed from the byte count that it was a big one. He moved it into a central share and then opened it in AutoCAD. It took several seconds, even on his powerful Unix workstation. When it was finished loading, he stared for some moments at the wireframe model now rotating in three dimensions on his screen. Ours is not to wonder why, but to do our... What the hell was he looking at? He turned back to the Mustang. Guys, get over here and look at this. Kahn wiped his forehead, smudging grease across it.
Later, man. This steering column's a bitch.
No, I think you should take a look at this now. Kahn rolled his eyes dramatically, then tapped forcefully on Magruder's shoulder.
What?
Kahn pointed.
Goggles says we gotta see the new plans. It's urgent. Fuck.
Magruder threw down his wrench with a clang, and the two of them strode leisurely toward Volker's workstation.
This had better be good, Kurt.
Volker simply gestured to the screen. Both men wrinkled their brows.
What the?
You have got to be kidding me.
Volker shook his head. They exchanged looks. It had always remained unsaid. They knew that some would suffer the demon's wrath. After the events at Sobel's mansion, the purpose of the automates could scarcely be a mystery. But they always nursed a hope that perhaps they would be used for transporting critical materials, operatives, or something unimaginably brilliant. Volker sighed and sat on a nearby stool. Kahn pointed at the screen.
What is that?
Magruder pointed too.
This is serious shit, Kurt.
Volker kept his eyes on the floor.
It's just aftermarket customization.
Magruder laughed.
No kidding. That's not what I mean.
Kahn was nodding.
He's right, Kurt. This is designed for one thing and one thing only. Killing people.
They contemplated this silently. This raised the stakes. They were now clearly producing weaponry. The pleasant fiction was over. Kahn added,
I mean, it's cool looking and all, but this is real life, not a fucking computer game.
What do we do?
Volker tapped his fingers on the workbench, thinking.
I've almost got the current order filled. While I finish that, we can decide the best course of action.
Magruder threw up his hands.
Like we have any choice, Kurt? If we don't make these things, our own toys are going to come back and kill us.
All right, calm down.
Kahn gripped his own head.
I should have known this was going to happen. It was too perfect.
Magruder waved it aside.
Let's stop kidding ourselves. We all know we're going to build these things, so why go through the theatrics of feeling bad about it?
Magruder grabbed a grease pencil and turned to a whiteboard. He started drawing a casualty list with little human stick figures.
If we don't make them, someone else will, and people will die. Along with us. That's X number of people plus 3. If we do make them, then people will die, but not us. That's X number of people plus 0.
He looked up, vindicated by mathematics.
So, we take the course that harms the least number of people.
Volker threw a glove at him.
That's fucking convenient.
Magruder held up his hands.
Don't blame me. We all got into this, and I don't feel like finding out what happens if we quit. Big things are changing in the world, things we can't stop. We're just cogs in the machine, and if we malfunction, we'll be replaced. We owe it to ourselves to survive. Shit, we owe it to ourselves to thrive. That's what our ancestors did, and that's what we're gonna do. It's our natural fucking purpose.
Everyone was quiet as they sat listening to the grinding sound emanating from the Haas. Eventually, Volker nodded. I know you're right. I just didn't think I'd ever be playing this role. I wanted to design consumer electronics.
Khan leaned against the workbench.
I wanted to build suspension bridges. Newsflash, nobody gives a fuck what we want.
Magruder rapped his knuckles on the countertop.
So, how does the board of Autocracy Inc. vote? Do we elect to continue in our present endeavor?
They glanced at each other, then all raised their hands.
Aye.
Magruder nodded.
The ayes have it. This will make a massively parallel cybernetic organism very happy.
He pointed to the busy Haas.
When are these pieces due?
Volker thought for a moment.
They need to be placed at the waypoints by tomorrow noon.
Magruder was back to examining the computer screen.
We'll need time to study these schematics. They look involved.
He peered closely at the screen.
This is serious engineering. Look at that flywheel housing and those hydraulics.
Volker nodded.
Graphite epoxy flywheel spinning at 70,000 RPMs in a vacuum, floating on a bed of magnetism.
Khan was pointing at the screen again.
You gotta admit, that's some cool shit. It even looks nasty. We should render it to see what it looks like in color.
Magruder ignored him.
When does the first stock unit arrive?
Volker grabbed the mouse and navigated to the header of the message.
He read for a moment. Friday.
Magruder pointed at the Haas.
You need help to finish these pieces on time?
No, they'll be done.
Magruder started back toward the Mustang.
Then I suggest we study those plans and make sure we're the best damn cogs the demon has.
Chapter 38, Assembly. He was a poster child for overdesigned American culture. His square-toed dress shoes had the soles of hiking boots, as though he intended to navigate an urban cliff face. His draping dress pants concealed six pockets pleated into its folds, each one with a trademark name, e.g., E-Pouch, TM, and giving him the cargo capacity of a World War I infantryman. Yellow tint sunglasses wrapped his face, unaccountably designed to withstand the impact of a small caliber rifle bullet, while filtering out UV rays and maximizing visual contrast in a wide range of indoor and outdoor lighting conditions. In all, his outfit required nearly 2,000 man-years of research and development, 8 barrels of oil, and 16 patent and trademark infringement lawsuits, all so he could possess casual style. A style that, in logistical requirements, was comparable to fielding a 19th-century military brigade. But he looked good. Casual. He walked along the city streets, passing coffee bars and cafes so packed with people that it seemed as if no one had homes to go to. He passed dogs with backpacks and kids wearing rollerblade sneakers, everybody with casual style. It felt good to be among them again. His depression had almost swallowed him whole when his first job was sent offshore. Then his second job. Then his third. Not much call for project managers in the States anymore. But now, he understood again. The world made sense. And he was still all for progress. Disruptive innovation, they called it. Change was good. Painful, but good. It made you stronger. When you stopped changing, you started dying. For the first time in years, he knew his situation was secure. He knew he could afford rent, even in his price-inflated neighborhood, that he could dress and live in a style befitting a man of his intelligence and education. He no longer compared unfavorably with people in magazine articles. He was back on track. He had a purpose, and right now, that purpose was to proceed to a specific GPS waypoint and await further instructions from the voice. The voice's feminine synthetic words came over his wireless earpiece.
Cross the street.
He obeyed and found himself moving into a crowded retail plaza ringed with national chain stores. The carnival atmosphere was augmented by street performers wearing photo IDs, proof that their family-friendly drug-tested talents were on an officially sanctioned list in the management office. The plaza was packed with consumers. The voice spoke again.
Waypoint 9 attained. Stand by. Stand by. Vector 271. Proceed.
He turned in place, looking closely at a handheld GPS screen until he was facing 271 degrees. Then, he proceeded at a normal walking pace as people jostled past him.
Report ready status of assembly.
The demon's workshop was open for business. He slipped one hand into his e-pouch, TM, and removed a grooved steel machine part 6 inches long. He wrapped his hand around it and kept walking Vector 271.
Assembly ready.
Prepare to tender.
He could see the target approaching through the crowd. A 20-something white kid in parachute pants and a sweatshirt bearing a university acronym. He had the calm, composed look of a demon courier. They were on a collision course as people swirled around them like random electrons. The kid extended his right hand as he came forward. They were just feet away.
Tender assembly on phrase, Hey, Luther. Confirm.
The kid came right up to him, holding forward a different steel part. A cell phone headset was now visible on his close-cropped head. The kid nodded.
Hey, Luther!
Both men extended their hands and slid the steel parts together. They mated perfectly with a satisfying click.
Assembly confirmed.
A pleasant chime sounded over the line.
Operation complete. 20 network credits. Demobilize.
The kid took control of the combined parts and continued walking. The voice came over the phone headset.
Assembly stage 2. Vector 168. Prepare to tender.
The kid held the assembly down at his side, turned to the appropriate compass direction, and proceeded through the crowd at a brisk walk. In a few moments, he and a young woman locked onto each other. She was big-boned, dressed like a business person, utterly invisible to most men. The kid vectored in.
Tender assembly on phrase, Afternoon, Rudy. Confirm.
The woman nodded as she came up to him, a flip phone handset held to her cheek.
Afternoon, Rudy.
He placed the two-part assembly into her hand and disappeared into the crowd.
Assembly confirmed.
A pleasant chime sounded over the line.
Operation complete. 20 network credits. Demobilize.
She snapped the kid's two parts into a yellow plastic base and moved through the crowd following her new vector. As he headed back to the parking structure, the kid imagined the tactical assembly now underway. Like swarming nanobots amid the mass of shoppers, the demon's distributed assembly plant ran half a dozen independent lines, with no individual having knowledge of anything more than the few seconds in front of them and the mechanics of the single assembly for which they'd be responsible. The parts arrived in place at the moment they were required, the voice vectoring them into a collision course. Assemblers came and went, passing the assembly on to the next worker in the chain after confirming completion of their step. Redundancy gave high probability that sufficient parts would arrive on station at the appropriate moment, and that waylaid assemblers could be quickly replaced. What he didn't know was what they were building. He wondered if he'd ever know. In the battered lobby of a C-grade office building, a now debt-free graduate student faced the wall and clicked a methane oxide fuel cell battery into place inside a form-fitting plastic handle. The voice spoke to him over his earpiece.
Confirm assembly completion.
He powered the unit up and waited for a diagnostics check. A green light came on. Ready. He lowered the assembly out of sight.
Assembly complete.
A pause.
Stand by. Stand by.
He looked around the lobby. It was a typical two-story box in a low-end tech park. Security consisted of locked doors with mag card swipes at the entrances. In other words, no security. Long halls laid with orange indoor-outdoor carpeting crossed each other in a barren atrium in the center of the building.
He waited patiently in a water company uniform, complete with photo ID badge and water bottle-laden handcart, as the voice kept repeating,
"Stand by,"
in his ear every 10 seconds. Then it paused.
"Vector 209, prepare to tender completed assembly."
This was it. The receiver was coming. He glanced at his GPS and turned to face the security door. Charles Moseley walked briskly toward the lobby doors. It was a bright spring day under a wide Texas sky. He could see his reflection in the door glass as he approached. He was dressed in a phone company uniform with tool belt, clipboard, and phone headset. He swiped his security card, and the door opened with a buzz. The voice spoke on the headset.
"Receive assembly on phrase, here it is."
Moseley approached a young Asian man standing in the lobby with a handcart piled with 5-gallon water cooler jugs. As he walked by, the man extended an odd-looking steel and yellow plastic device to him. It was shaped like a glue gun with the top section missing. An empty channel with twin grooved steel plates.
"Here it is."
Moseley grabbed it with his work-gloved hands and shoved it into a slot on his utility belt designed specifically for it. He heard the waterman exit the lobby doors behind him, but he walked purposefully on his appointed vector, passing a nondescript guy in a pullover shirt bearing some company's logo. He nodded congenially as he went past, but the guy didn't acknowledge him in the least, just some tenant.
"Vector 155,
the voice said in Moseley's ear. That was straight down the corridor. Moseley kept moving down the hall, glancing at office doors. Suite 500. 10 minutes ago, he thought he was going to tap a phone system. But now, in possession of the assembly, he recognized it immediately. He had used it before. It was an electronic pistol. Manufactured with bright yellow plastic and brushed steel, it resembled a battery-powered hand tool. It even had a tool company logo on the side. But in reality, it was a fully automatic, precision-made handgun. It was nearly 100% reliable because it had no moving parts. Instead of a firing pin and complex recoil-based reloading mechanism, an electronic pistol was a fire-by-wire device. The caseless bullets were stacked in a straight line in one of 4 parallel 12-inch barrels, and a logic chip fired each bullet independently with bolts of electricity from an onboard battery. The gun was reloaded by slapping on new barrels of ammunition. Moseley had already received 3 rapid loaders from a courier out in the street. It was a foolproof, untraceable weapon designed for one thing: killing people at close range. Suite 710. He steeled himself. There was a grander purpose at work here. He had to keep reminding himself of that. This wasn't the same as what he'd done as a teen. He wasn't doing this for himself. The world was changing. He'd seen it. This was part of the plan. There were no random acts in the plan. The voice said,
"Stop."
Suite 1010. Moseley drew the unloaded pistol, then took the welded steel barrels from the other side of his tool belt. He slid the two together with a click-clack. It was now loaded and looked very much like a garish toy laser pistol. The voice came to his ears.
"Device code 4915.
Moseley flipped the gun and tapped in the 4-digit code at the base of the handle. The device was now armed. He turned to face the door. Then he reached into his pocket and produced a hard plastic door key given to him by a woman out on the street. All master key systems were vulnerable to mathematical reduction. The voice continued in his earpiece.
"Confirm instructions. Kill the occupants of suite 1010.
Moseley closed his eyes. He didn't relish this. He thought he'd left this behind years ago. But the demon had found him out. It knew he had killed before. He took a deep breath, then said, "Instruction confirmed."
"Proceed."
Moseley inserted the key, turned it, and pushed the door open.
he moved into a cluttered office with shelving piled high with papers and boxes on the far wall. Banks of cheap desktop computers sat atop folding tables. A 30-something guy with a sizable gut turned quickly in his chair to face Mosley. He had a cherry Danish almost up to his mouth.
You can't just...
Mosley raised the pistol and sent a quick burst into the man's chest, spattering the computer table and back wall with gore. A couple of frangible rounds slammed into the wall and dissolved into puffs of powder, barely leaving a dent in the drywall. Frangible rounds still amazed Mosley. The bullets were made of compressed ceramic powder. They retained their hitting power if they hit soft human tissue, but they disappeared in a cloud of dust if they encountered an unyielding surface, like a wall. They were designed to contain a shootout within the room where the shooting was taking place, and they also eliminated the risk of ricochets. This last part was of particular concern when you were spraying 7 rounds a second in a room 10 feet square. The bloody fat man slumped and fell onto the floor with a thud that shook the room. Mosley heard movement in the next office further in, the squeaking of a desk chair.
Mav, what was that?
Mosley advanced quickly, both hands gripping the pistol. No need to worry about their calling the police. Their phones were out by now, and their cell phones would already be jammed. He stepped into a larger office area containing 2 desks and a bank of windows looking out onto the back parking lot. A young man stood behind a desk, hand reaching into the center drawer, a look of disbelief on his face. Mosley ripped out a longer burst this time. With the suppressor, it sounded like a muted model airplane engine. The wall, windows, and drop ceiling were now spattered with blood. Smoke wafted away from the gun barrel. Mosley turned as another man screamed in terror. The man ducked behind his desk, dragging a phone with him. Shit. Mosley popped the smoking barrels off and clicked on a new set. He advanced, gun ready, and could hear the man sputtering in terror as he tapped at the dead phone.
No, I'll give you money. Don't!
Mosley came around the side of the desk and aimed his gun down at the man cowering against the wall.
No, please!
Mosley hesitated. God damn it. It could not be left undone. There was no question.
No!
Mosley emptied the barrel into him. The man slumped sideways behind the desk in a pool of blood, his body twitching. Mosley loaded the last barrel and retraced his steps, putting another couple of shots into the heads of the 2 other men. He spoke into his headset. Task complete. There was a pause, then the voice said,
Confirmed. 2,000 network credits. Demobilize.
Mosley tapped a sequence of numbers onto a 4 keypad on the bottom of the gun and tossed it onto the top of a nearby desk. The weapon started to sizzle and smoke, then the plastic bulk of it began to melt, along with its circuitry. Mosley took a small semicircular device off his tool belt. The thing resembled a small traveling alarm clock with a rounded bottom. He tapped the same 4-key code into the device, then tossed it into the center of the floor, where it rolled around for several moments while Mosley exited the way he came in. As the device came to rest on its rounded bottom, a pocket laser beamed bright red light onto the stained drop tiles of the ceiling, creating a marquee-like sign in large glowing red letters. The letters spelled out the message the demon wanted to send.